The system of breath practice that was beloved to the Buddha and is beloved to the early Buddhist system is in its clearest form expressed in the discourse known as mindfulness of breathing or mindfulness of in and out breathing. The Pali term is anapanasati. Sati is translated as mindfulness. You could also translate it as a kind of intimate knowing, where we come into contact with things in a conscious and intentional way, and we know them as they arise. So we understand how things arise, we understand suffering as we come into contact with the world, we understand pleasure and pain, we understand who we are in relation to the arising and passing of things in the world. All of this is part of mindfulness, sati. The word sati is also connected to the quality of memory and remembering. And so it's the quality that's present when we are remembering a long passage of text. Remember that this is a teaching that comes from the days before writing and reading. In fact, right, you know, almost contemporary to the Buddha, Plato, some couple thousand miles away, up in Greece, was writing that the dawn of writing and people reading and writing instead of just remembering and storytelling was going to be the end of the mind as they knew it. The mind would be irrevocably changed by the arrival of writing. He was right. He had no idea what was coming next. Now you might notice how much of your old reading and writing mind has been changed by the arrival of the internet and the screens and the infinite memory of the robot you carry in your pocket. But sati is the quality of memory that enables us to remember things. And the text says the quality that enables us to remember things that were done and said long ago. And so there is a quality of memory and even of cultural memory that is contained in this thing called mindfulness. This is partly because mindfulness is not just a passive noticing of whatever is arising in the present, but it's a noticing of important things that are arising in the present. Things are important because they matter. They matter for our own well-being, for our happiness, and for awakening. And so in a world where lots of things arise, thoughts and stories and other people's opinions, you know, proliferate, those are not the appropriate objects of mindfulness. We are not meant to just notice all the things arising, right? The primary text on mindfulness practice is the Satipatthana Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 10. Majjhima Nikaya is the middle-length discourses of the Buddha. The Satipatthana is the foundations or establishment of mindfulness. And it is not a text on bare or open attention. It's a text that begins with cultivating intimate, knowing, clear-seeing attention to the body as it moves through space, as it finds itself breathing, and it contains the first four steps of the Anapanasati sequence we'll talk about. It says, notice the body as a collection of the same elements that comprise everything in the natural world. And notice the body as a collection of parts that are just different things. You know, the eye, the ear, the nose, the bones, the muscles, the blood, you know, all the things, the different parts. And then notice, of course, that the body is part of the ecosystem in which everything dies. And so visualize the body as a corpse and just remember your own mortality and the mortality of those you love. This is mindfulness of the body. Mindfulness goes on to say, be mindful of feelings, pleasant, unpleasant, and neither. Be mindful of mind states like greed or lust, hatred and delusion, concentration and distraction, liberation and non-liberation. Really be aware of the state of your mind and heart. And then going further, be aware of the presence of particular qualities in the body-mind that are important on the path. Be aware of the hindrances. Be aware of the aggregates, the things we cling to. Be aware of the wholesome qualities of the awakening factors. And the constituent factors of the six senses, the physical senses and the heart-mind. And be aware of the noble truths, you know, in your direct experience. Oh, this is suffering. This is clinging. This is non-clinging. This is the path. So mindfulness is very specific. It's not abstract and it's not passive. We have to look for these things. And we cultivate the states and the power, really, to see things clearly. This is what mindfulness is. So there's a text on the establishment of mindfulness. And then there's a second text. This is the other big primary meditative text in the canon, the text known as the Anapanasati Sutta, mindfulness of breathing. It's the only other text that uses the word mindfulness in the title to describe a whole practice. You know, lots of other texts say cultivate mindfulness. And what they mean is cultivate the four foundations of mindfulness. But this text says very specifically, cultivate mindfulness of breathing. And I'm not going to talk about the beginning of the text very much, but I will encourage you to read it. There's a link to it in the Facebook group, and I'll just drop the link to it here. I've got it open in side-by-side version, so you'll just see that if you open this, where you'll see the Pali. But at the beginning of the text, the Buddha, the beginning of the text is quite beautiful. The Buddha does something that is not in very many texts. He praises the Sangha. He says, oh, the monks are practicing so well. There's great teachers, and those teachers are teaching their students, and everyone's practicing really well. I'm so satisfied. I'm going to stay here longer. And more monks come around. They find out he's staying. And then a month goes by. It's a full moon night. And again, he says, this gathering of monks, this is great. Everyone's practicing so well. I'm so pleased. People are learning. This is really good. And he says, you know, there are monks here that are fully liberated and almost fully liberated and kind of liberated and rather liberated and on the path to being liberated. He praises the path the monks are on. And he says, there are monks here that are devoted to this practice and that practice, devoted to mindfulness practice, to concentration practice, to to Brahma Vihara practice, to loving kindness and compassion, joy and equanimity. And he lists out what came to be known as the 37 wings to awakening. So he says, there are monks or mendicants, practitioners here. So this is male and female monastics, bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, who are committed to developing the four kinds of mindfulness meditation, so that's satipatthana, who are committed to developing the four right efforts, the four bases of psychic power, the five faculties, the five powers, the seven awakening factors, the Noble Eightfold Path. If you want a collection of the lists that you should know, memorize this list of lists. It's 37 things total. And it's a little bit less even because the faculties and powers are the same list. One is when you're practicing them, and one is when you've really got them going on. So he says there's monks practicing all these things. It's so beautiful. And then he says, and there are monks practicing mindfulness of breathing. And then he swings into the full description of mindfulness of breathing. So read the beginning of the text at some point. It's glorious. It inspires faith. I think it's a beautiful picture of a mature contemplative community practicing together and just enjoying being together, practicing deeply together. What a thing to have in the world, you know, that this happened, whether literally or mythically or both, you know. So All of that is the beginning of the text. And then the Buddha says, you know, here's what mindfulness of breathing is. So we have been using in our meditation the first four steps of mindfulness of breathing for quite a long time. I use it pretty much as the basis of my sitting practice. And it's a really beautiful way to start a sitting practice. And it starts with, you know, bringing the body to a comfortable upright seat, to a meditative posture, and then bringing mindfulness to the foreground and bringing mindfulness into contact with the breathing process, with in and out breathing. That's really the foundation. That is the place, in a certain way, where contemporary mindfulness instructions usually stop or often stop, especially in the secular mindfulness world. And I'm not going to waste any more time critiquing that movement. All I want to say is it's good, it's a start, and it gets as far as the preliminaries in this text. And then the text goes on. So we'll go from there. You begin by bringing mindfulness to in and out breathing. This is the part where you are noticing the breath. So, right, there's that aspect of mindfulness that's just knowing clearly what's happening. And so this is training in knowing what's happening. Am I breathing in or out? The great Burmese teacher, the student of Mahasi Sayadaw, Upandita, who was one of the root teachers in the insight meditation lineage, he would say, notice when you fall asleep at night, whether you fall asleep on an in-breath or an out-breath. And then notice when you wake up, whether you wake up on an in-breath or an out-breath. Now that ain't easy, people. You know, the mind generally wanders far afield right before you go to sleep, and it wanders for a while coming out of the dream time as you're waking up. But he was talking in the context of a pretty intensive retreat practice where you are naming what's happening moment to moment all day from the moment you wake up to the moment you go to sleep. You are instructed to name the burst of volition that precedes the opening of the eyes, when you have an impulse to open your eyes in the morning, and then to notice the movement of the eyelids when you respond to that volition by opening the eyes, and then to notice the seeing of light and forms that comes in. You have to move pretty slowly through the day to do this, but you do this for a while, a few weeks, a few months. The longest I ever did it was 5 months at a stretch in one of the Mahasi monasteries in Burma. It was pretty trippy, pretty intense. I did get dengue fever in the middle of that, so I was noting, you know, being sick and delirious and all that. But I kept trying. And the noting whether you're falling asleep or waking up on an in-breath or an out-breath becomes actually possible because you are habituating the mind to really notice moment by moment. Even if you don't get all the way there, in ordinary life, practice in the moments before you fall asleep, see if you can notice the transition between waking and sleeping. This is also part of the lucid dreaming practice that can become very helpful at different times. It's hard for me to notice it, to be perfectly honest, because what I'll notice is that as I'm heading towards sleep, it'll be harder to stay concentrated and quiet the mind. So I'll first become a little distracted, right? My volitional effort is sinking. And so I'll become a little distracted and I won't actually notice the falling into sleep because the distraction becomes dream. And I'll cross into unconsciousness in the middle of a distraction. But you know, like distraction and dreaming are not that different. If you're not aware of distraction, you're not aware of dreaming. They're considered parallel states. That's partly why it's really awesome to do lucid dreaming practice. Start to become lucid during your dreams, and you can start to become lucid during your waking distractions, your daydreams. And then you realize that the entire universe is a construction of your own mind. So there's that. But back to breathing. You begin, this is the foundation, by noticing the in and out breath. And then the first four steps of mindfulness of breathing, anapanasati, are, it's called the first tetrad. Anapanasati is presented as a 16-step process, and it's in four groups of four that are a bit symmetrical. So we'll talk through the first two today. And we've been using the first four steps, the first tetrad, as our basis for meditation for a while. So the first tetrad goes like this. the practitioner knows the long breath in and the long breath out. So the first step is to be aware of long breaths. I practice this in a lineage of folks who understand this as giving an invitation to altering the breath to make it long as part of the training, as part of really conditioning your energy at the beginning of a practice. So I will start off by taking a bunch of long breaths, really breathing in deep, letting a long breath out deep. You can also practice this as suggesting that with a passive natural breath, you just notice long breaths when they naturally arise. That's fine too. You can do that as well. That's a less, slightly less volitionally engaged practice. But if you're concentrating, it can be just as strong in terms of developing concentration. I like the massaging of the energy that happens when I really consciously take a bunch of long breaths. And then I'm also really feeling, this is a long breath. This is what long breath feels like through the body. I'm feeling the breath pour in through the nose, into the chest, diaphragm moves down into the belly, into the bowl of the hips, and really bringing the wave of the breath all the way down to the base of the pelvis. And the whole central column begins to be held by the breath. So the first step is the long breath. And the second step is to become aware or to know the short breath in and the short breath out. So after a bunch of long breaths, if you're doing the volitional style as I do, then I let go of pulling a long breath in and I let the breath settle into a gentler rhythm. And often that means it's a little shorter, a little softer, a little shallower, not in an extreme way. But I'm using a bit less effort and I'm inclining towards stillness, and the whole first tetrad inclines towards stillness. So in the second step, the short breath. And again, you can practice this in a way where you're just observing the natural breath and you're noting when the breath is short and when the breath is long, and doing that for the first two steps. You're continuing also to cultivate some concentration. So when there's distraction, we're not doing vipassana here, where we would observe the content of the distraction and note the hindrance and feel its vedana, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, and stay with it for a bit and understand your psychology, and none of that, you know, bowing to Mara. In this practice, it's really a concentration practice or an immersion practice. Mind starts to get distracted, you just set it down and immediately return to the breath. So not even giving it any mind, no worries, just right back to breathing. Try not to miss a breath. The third step in the first tetrad is to train or practice feeling the breath in the whole body or breathing with the whole body. This is a step that has differing instructions depending on what lineage you're in. Some folks coming from some of the commentarial traditions understand this to mean knowing the full body of the breath. So feel the beginning, middle, and end of the breath. That's a nice way to cultivate concentration because you really stay with the whole breath coming in and the turnaround and the whole breath going out. So please do that. That's a good thing to do. But if you've been already tracking the long breath and the short breath, that's kind of implied. You have to stay with the whole length of the breath to know whether it's long or short. So I think, along with some scholars and monastics that I happen to like, I like an interpretation here where the invitation actually is to feel the whole body, to really connect with the whole physical body. And here what I do is I take the knowing of the breath, so I've been with the fluctuating of the breath, and I mix that awareness with the awareness of the posture of the body that I began the meditation with. So there's the sense of sitting in whatever posture I'm in. I let myself feel that. That's the cognitive quality known as proprioception, knowing the shape of the body from the inside. I let the proprioceptive sense mix with the knowing of the breath. A different way to feel this is you might take the physical breath movement, like you feel the diaphragm moving, or you feel the ribs opening, or you feel the breath at the nose tip even. And you just let the sense of that wave expand until it encompasses the whole body, even go a little past the body. And what you can feel here is you can begin to feel the wave of the breathing through the arms, through the legs, maybe through the head, the back. And you can come into a really delicious sense of the whole body pulsing with the breath, right? We know it's not the physical breath moving, but the physical breath sets up a kind of wave and the whole body can feel it. This is a hint of where we're going to go in the second tetrad. So the third step is to feel the breath in the whole body. And then the fourth step is to relax the body or to bring the body toward stillness. And again, one of the commentarial interpretations here is to bring the breath towards stillness, which is where it goes when it's in deep concentration. For now, I want to just say, particularly because we're using this as a meditation instruction, even if deep concentration isn't present yet, I want to say, bring the body, the breathing body, this energetic pulsing body toward a deeper stillness, a deeper tranquility. So that's the first tetrad. Long breaths starts to condition the energy. Short breaths softens the volition, the effort, inclines towards stillness. Feel the pulsation of the breath through the whole body. Now the whole body is shimmering with breath. And then still the body even more. Often just send a wave of the instruction to relax down through the body. So we've been practicing with those as a foundation for meditation. And I think it's a beautiful foundation. From there, you might just rest with the natural breath as an anchor, or you might go into another kind of vipassana, naming things or doing body sweeps or scans or something else, Brahmavihara practice, metta practice. Or you can go on with the steps of mindfulness of breathing. So the second tetrad. Step five, the beginning of the second tetrad, is to train myself to feel rapture as I breathe. So rapture is the Pali word piti. It's one of the factors of deep concentration or jhana. And it can sometimes get translated as joy or bliss, but I like rapture. It's a nice classic term. It sounds awesome. It is rather awesome. But we can think of rapture a couple ways. Often when rapture is talked about in the texts, it's talked about really as a physical kind of heightened energy. And we might cross traditions here and say that it's not different from what later Hindu traditions, Shaiva traditions would call Kundalini, and what the Tibetan traditions would call Chandali or Tummo, the inner fire or the goddess of the inner heat. But if we stick with the more phenomenological somatic description in the Pali texts, rapture is a good word for it. It's described as sometimes like a subtle thrill that moves through the body, like the hairs standing on end on your body, or like a wave of energy through the body, or like sparks showing up through the body, or like big pulses in the body, or like jolts of lightning in the body that might later be called kriyas in the yogic system. It's energy. It's energy. One of the things I like about calling all of those things piti, rather than calling them, you know, kriya or kundalini, is that piti helps us stay a bit out of some of the stories that can arise around this energy. In later devotional traditions, stories get spun about, you know, waking up the coiled goddess that lives 3.5 times coiled around the base of the spine, awakens with the drawing upward of cosmic sexual energy into the furnace of the belly. You know, like there's a really beautiful and evocative language that starts to arise in the yogic systems around how you wake up energy in the body. In the Tibetan systems, the word tummo literally means like the female goddess of you know, warmth or bliss or blissful heat. So there's that element. But piti, just refers to the experience, the sensational experience of awakening energy in the body. So here we are in this breath practice where the first tetrad has brought us actually toward a fairly subtle breath and a very still body. So the emphasis here actually is on tranquility and subtlety, and on feeling that the movement of subtle breath energy through the whole body. So I think the first opening to piti that we have in this sequence is not a big dramatic, like jolty energy or a big buzzy energy. For a lot of folks, it's just the subtle vibratory sensation of the breath in the whole body. So even just feeling the whole body in a state where there's not a lot of distraction, there's not a lot pulling you away, you'll get a kind of subtle vibration, you know? Some of you all have done the Goenka style Vipassana practice where you do a slow body scan down from the crown of the head toward the tips of the toes. When you do this kind of practice, what you notice is that when you bring your attention to a certain part of the body, any part, you know, you bring your attention to your left shoulder, you might try it now. Pour your attention into the shoulder, just feel the shoulder. And after about 3 or 4 seconds, a kind of subtle presence will blossom there. You'll feel it. You weren't noticing it before, but sensation will actually wake up where attention goes. And so then you gradually stitch together the proprioception of the whole body with your awareness. And then very slowly, and it takes some slowness. One Goenka teacher I talked to once said, you know, honestly, if I'm doing my own practice of the body scan, if I'm really trying to contact with presence the sensation in every place before I go on, it takes me about 2 hours to move through the body to do one sweep from head to toe. Because you have to wait for numbness to open up into sensation. Well, what's it opening up into? It's a kind of vibratory presence, and you could call that piti. It's very, very gentle piti. So here in the fifth step, you train to feel piti, rapture. We've already connected with the whole body breathing. I think here for rapture, you might just shift your attention toward the buzzy aspect of that breath wave in the whole body, right? And even the pleasurable aspect of that breath wave, because rapture is not just the vibrations, but they feel good generally. They're supposed to feel good. So feel the whole body breathing, and then really tune into whatever aspect of that feels good. That might mean that you have to ignore aspects that don't feel good. Like if there's a little ache in your hip while you're sitting, you know, or your mind is a little bit busy with something that's unpleasant in your life. You have to ignore that. This is a skill to cultivate. Ignore that for now and tune your attention to the pleasure in the body that is here if you can listen for it. It might takes a few seconds. You really tune into it, and that becomes the object of meditation for a little while, is the pleasurable breath or the delicious breath. That's step 5. Step 6 is a subtler variation of that. It says the practitioner trains in breathing with happiness or bliss. The word is sukha. It's the subtler of the energetic pleasures in concentration. Piti is the janglier or rougher or more somatic. This is the same thing, but shifted in the direction of ease and smoothness and emotion. So sukha, I like to just translate it as happiness or ease. So now I've been present with the whole body breathing and the sense of the vibratory loveliness of the breath body. And now I shift a little further toward just enjoying that. And the enjoyment of it becomes the thing I'm cultivating. Here's where I will often suggest, take a little smile at the corners of the mouth, as if you're reminding yourself that this is great. You just give a little like, ah. And again, you might have to compartmentalize some discomfort to do this. Like, yes, my foot is a little sore, my heart is a little broken, and right in this very moment, I have the extraordinary privilege and pleasure of breathing and sitting in a way that feels good. And it is healthy to feel good. The Buddha very directly asked himself when he discovered this practice. He said, is this a pleasure that should be feared? Am I going to grasp onto it? Is it sensual in a way that's going to cause lust or greed or confusion? And he knew in himself, this is a pleasure not to be feared. So this is the most wholesome pleasure we can have. It doesn't take anything away from anyone else. It doesn't burn up any resources. It doesn't rely on oil or praise or money. Really, it's all you. And it's not that difficult if you can compartmentalize your anxiety a teensy bit. So that's just it. Ah, this is so nice. That's step six. Step seven turns us in a slightly different direction, but it's going to make sense. Step seven is to know clearly and understand the drama, let's say, of the mind. The Pali word is citta sankhara. Citta is the conscious mind. And sankhara, some of you will know, as the fourth of the aggregates. It's often translated as mental formations or karmic formations or volitional formations. Bhikkhu Sujato just translates it as choices. So it's the volitional narrative content in the heart mind. It's all the things you're obsessed about. It's your ideas of yourself, your ideas of other people, the narratives that you're carrying around, the views that you're carrying around, all that stuff, that's sankhara. And it is in the way of liberation, right? It's some of the main material we cling to that we get lost in, that we get deluded about. So this is a really interesting moment in practice because we are turning towards something that is often unpleasant and or unwholesome in relation to liberation, but it needs to be understood. In trauma practice, there's a principle often that encountering trauma material is best done after first resting the mind in the contact with something pleasurable. My teacher Steve Hoskinson would say, like, you have to stabilize pleasure or ease before you go anywhere near traumatic material. And so I think of this very much in that way. Like, we've just spent six entire steps saturating the body with stability, pleasure, rapture, you know, stillness, ease. When this is really flowing, you're in a very yummy state at this point. And then it says, now bring into your awareness the citta sankhara, all the stuff. And so here's where you open the cupboard where you put all that, you compartmentalized all that stuff for the first six steps. And you're like, oh, I'm heartbroken about the war, and I'm sad about my neighbor's dog who just died, and parenting is really hard, and my hip hurts, and my, you know, all the things, right? And you don't get lost in them because you're so clear. The mind is quite focused at this point that it's really a support not to fall down the whirlpool with all that stuff. But you see it clearly. You say, oh, this stuff. Oh, I get so lost in this stuff. This is the stuff. And you get it. And you can hold it with some compassion. You might still be like coursing with somatic and emotional pleasure. What a beautiful state to contact your shit from. So I'm colloquially translating citta sankhara as your shit. So there you go. Connect with the citta sankhara. And then step eight is to bring the citta sankhara to stillness. So shut up. Shit. Shut the shit up. My wife did just get me a t-shirt with a picture of the Buddha and it says, let that shit go. So there you go. There's actually a sticker that says that at our local skate park, where I've been taking my kids. So I go with my kid to the skate park and the sticker is like, and there's the Buddha. He says, let that shit go. All right. I don't say the word shit when I'm teaching at Spirit Rock, you know, but here you go. Thanks, friends. Let that shit go. So in step eight, you let that shit go. And what that means is particular to the concentration practice, because it doesn't mean that we've resolved all that energy and we've let it go completely in a kind of liberated from that sort of way. This is still a concentration practice. And that still means that what we're doing in a certain way is compartmentalizing it. We're letting it go for now. And this is interesting because we've had to, in a certain way, compartmentalize it to get this far. Now there's a moment where, in a certain way, we let it come out, we see it, we meet it with the bliss body, and then the way it feels, the way I understand this, kind of in my own body when I get to touch this, is almost like I touch the most palpable layers of nervous system activation that are here. I connect with the energy of anxiety, the energy of fear, the energy of anger, frustration. I connect with that from this blissful body, and I allow that emotional or energetic force to subside, right? The shit will still, you know, be there. Like, the world still sucks in those ways, but there's a kind of energetic shift that I can come into where I meet the challenges of my life with this blissful body, and I let it subside. And here, we've done the parallel in the second tetrad. We bring the mind, or the citta sankhara, the stuff of the mind, really, not the mind itself, but the stuff of the mind, to stillness. The same way that in the first tetrad, we connected with the whole body and then brought the body to stillness. So the first tetrad is all somatic. It's all the body. The second one starts with the subtler somatic pleasures in the energetic body, and then it allows those to be the foundation for inviting the stuff of the mind to settle. With those two tetrads, we have a foundation then for an aspect of insight practice. And in the third tetrad, which maybe we'll talk about next week, we start to turn toward seeing the world in certain ways. And the last two tetrads do turn toward both, you know, deeper concentration, the concentration of the jhanas, for instance, the deep absorption states, but also toward the knowing, the radical knowing that liberates the heart, the knowing of emptiness and the qualities of profound letting go that come. So this settling of the citta sankhara is like settling the surface layer of the mind stuff, so that we can drop down a couple layers and begin to unpack the threads of delusion and deep views that underlies the whole thing. So here we have in the first eight steps then, this is really, you can run through this in one meditation session. You know, you could do a brief version in several minutes, or you could let this eight steps kind of track through the first, you know, 20 or 30 minutes of a meditation, where you're really trying to feel each step come to some fruition. Like, before I move on to stilling the body, I want to really feel the breath in the whole body. I want to get there before I move on. And then, you know, before I move on from stilling the body, I want to really feel stillness, invite rapture, and spend a little while cultivating rapture. You know, maybe you alter the breath. Maybe you bring in a little more breath to breathe into the rapturous energy. And really feel it. Really feel the pleasure. And then really feel the citta sankhara. Oh. And then, and take a little while to really, you know, soothe that part of the heart. You know? And so practicing in that way, you can start to touch into, at the end of that sequence, a very still body that pulses with pleasurable, nourishing somatic energy, and then a mind that has been contacted and brought to a deeper place of stillness. From there, you know, once you get there, meditate as long as you can. Just stay. You know, don't kick the dog, just stay right there. And, you know, until the energy starts to dissipate, you know, and then, you know, sing your closing chants and go about your day. And that is a delicious practice. So, all right, so pause there. Beautiful to open into the second tetrad. It's kind of, I mean, who's it's sort of my favorite tetrad. Maybe they all are, but you know, the that rapture and bliss bit is pretty lovely if you can practice that. So.